You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 14th of January, 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we're broadcasting at radioaryan.com, and we also have Max Musson from Western Spring with us today. Max, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, yes. It's been a very relaxing weekend so far, actually. I've just been chilling out and did a bit of weight training this morning to keep fit, but and here I am this afternoon, full of the joys of spring.
Yeah, full of the joys of politics. I mean, we've had a really exciting week, really, I guess, to put it bluntly, talking about all the Brexit news in the Houses of Parliament, where they are debating Theresa May's deal with a view to voting on it on Tuesday. And I guess the most interesting part of all of this was Speaker Bercow's treason. And what he did was really quite shocking. I mentioned this earlier, last week on the Daily Nationalist, but I didn't really go into the details of it because I wasn't quite sure what he'd done. I knew that he'd broken with precedent in some way. But what he's actually done is far more than just breaking with precedent. He's broken all the traditions of the way that these bills are actually debated within the Houses of Parliament. Because they're actually debating Theresa May's deal, that means that nobody can make any amendments to it because it's already been done, it's been finished, the bill has then been put before Parliament. And what Bercow did, he allowed the Remainers to add an amendment to this bill. And more than that, the night before, the guy that was actually tabling this amendment to the bill, he went round to Bercow's house. So this was a deal that was done with them. Bercow was told, no, you can't do this. He was told this by his legal clerks. When he actually did it, his own team, the rest of the Conservatives, were absolutely stunned at this. And one of the Brexiteers stood up and said, well, can I table an amendment then? And he refused to allow the Brexiteer to table an amendment. Then somebody else stood up and said, well, can we see your legal advice for this? And don't forget, Bercow is the one that stood up a while back and said, can we see your legal advice that you've been given, Theresa May, about this deal? And he allowed that to go through. So again, he was the one that set this precedent that you could see the legal advice, which, again, that wasn't allowed before. And then he said, oh, no, this was all just verbal. This was just verbal, so I can't give you the legal advice that the clerks gave me. The clerks told him that if he was to allow this amendment to go through, it would be entirely unlawful, and it would set a precedent. And now he has set that precedent. They're now talking about backbenchers being able to add amendments to this bill as the deal goes through Parliament, and they're talking about a coup. Bercow himself, he drives around in a car with a bollocks to Brexit sticker in it, which he claims is his wife's car. And he's made no bones about it that he wants to thwart the democratic will of the British public and prevent Britain from pulling out of the EU. I mean, he's a really nasty, horrible piece of work. He reminds me actually of Dungeon Master from the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon from the 80s. He does look very similar to that. And then on top of this, they're now talking, we've also got this possibility of an election being called by Theresa May. But just before we actually get into that, I mean, what do you think of this Speaker Bercow and what he's actually done here, Max?
Well, I think this is just another example of people who are members of the political establishment, people who are in power at the moment, overstepping their prerogatives and abusing their position in order to influence the progress of this country in a way which is completely unconstitutional and undemocratic. John Bercow is our latest example of somebody doing this, but the whole progress of Brexit through the House of Commons, the fact that it's been such an extended process, it's all been designed to delay and frustrate the process of Brexit, to pervert the meaning of Brexit so that Brexit no longer actually means Brexit in the way that Theresa May declared it should do at the very beginning. And it's quite obvious that the actions of people who form our political establishment are that they may be able to claim that what they've done is, strictly speaking, isn't unlawful and they haven't necessarily committed a crime, but what they've actually done is something which is immoral, in that they have broken with accepted constitutional processes, etc., in order to, as I say, abuse the position of power they've got for their own political ends. And this is just going on all the time. And this is one of the reasons why members of the British public are continually losing confidence in our politicians. And this is why respect for politicians is at an all-time low and continuing to drop, because whilst members of the public may be powerless to actually do anything about it as individuals, they may actually be powerless to do anything about it necessarily even as groups, because with the recent legislation that's been introduced where counter-terrorism legislation and all that kind of thing has been used to suppress freedom of speech and freedom of expression, there are all the police state measures in place to frustrate people who try to organise themselves in opposition to what's taking place as well. And so it's creating a very dangerous situation. And the situation obviously isn't quite at boiling point at the moment, because otherwise there would be a lot of unrest. But we can already see the same situation developing across the channel in France and Germany, where these yellow vest people have been carrying out their protests. And that kind of thing is already starting to happen also in this country. And these are all signs that the public, that significant sections of the public, are starting to lose all respect for political establishment, and that can be can only be a dangerous thing, because if this process continues and people's confidence in the legitimacy of government continues to fall, a point is going to be reached at some point in the future where there is going to be some significant physical challenge to the existing political establishment, whether it's in this country or whether it's somewhere else on the continent. It's going to come sooner or later, unless the people who govern us at the moment decide to start playing by the rules that they've always claimed have been in place to ensure the constitutionality of the way in which we are governed, and the rules and the conventions that existed throughout most of the last century and the centuries beforehand, which have more than perhaps in other countries maintained social peace and orderliness and constitutionality in the way in which our public life has been conducted. But this all is set to break down further the more these kind of actions are taken by individuals, as I say, who abuse their positions of authority.
Right, he's just making it up as he goes along. And the rest of the Tory party is saying that he needs to be stripped of his peerage that the Speaker of the House is supposed to get when he finishes, because he's supposed to be completely unbiased. He's not supposed to be biased towards either side, and he's quite clearly showing a bias here towards the Ramonas by allowing their amendment to be tabled. And what this amendment does, it forces Theresa May to come up with her plan B within 3 days of what they call the meaningful vote on her deal. I mean, just the fact they call it the meaningful vote. I mean, what does that say? Does that say that all the other votes they have in there don't actually have any meaning? They're all just done for a laugh? But this meaningful vote, which will happen on Tuesday, it means she's got to come up with a plan B by Friday. which in actual fact, I mean, this might really be a good thing, because the only thing she can really do to outfox the Ramonas and the Labour Party is to call an election. And if she called an election and set a date for it, 17 days after we're supposed to leave the European Union, that would mean that they were unable to come up with any more laws to frustrate Brexit. Because she's promised that Brexit means Brexit, we will actually have to be leaving. And if Burko is going to be allowing people to table amendments, that they could start changing things, that they could change the law, what have you. But if she says we're going to have an election, then they all have to stop sitting in Parliament and they have to go out and they have to canvass for votes, basically. And she knows, I think, that when if this deal does get struck down, then Jeremy Corbyn is going to call for a vote of no confidence, and Jeremy Corbyn is going to start calling for an election. So if she was to call for it, it would really take the thunder out of Jeremy Corbyn being able to do it. It means that she'd actually be able to set the date for it. It means that we would have to leave the EU, and it would be the hard Brexit on World Trade Organization terms that everybody voted for. So I can see her possibly doing this just to outfox them. But that's the only way out that I see.
I think she could also possibly, though, call for a general election so that nobody can table any more amendments to her deal, and could then, in the hope that after a general election, she can, or that, you know, during the... let's just think. I don't know whether it is absolutely necessary that Parliament passes her bill or not.
No, because if they vote against it, this is the thing, they've got the vote on Tuesday, and everybody says they're all going to vote against it. So if they vote against it, she's got 3 days to come up with a plan B. And if she can't come up with a plan B, then they're all going to start trying to table amendments. They're going to start trying to reverse Article 50. They're going to try and stay within the EU. So if she says we're going to have an election, that means they have to stop all of that. They're not allowed to do any of that. Parliament has to be dissolved. And while it's dissolved, we'll leave the EU. And then a few days after we have left the EU, then there'll be the general election. That's the option that I'm pointing out. Because if she says that, they can't table any more amendments. They have to stop. It has to be dissolved, you see.
Yeah, but if she goes back to the European Union and asks for an extension on Article 50 until after the election, she may do that in the hope that she's going to win the general election and she can then push through her deal. But that may bring Corbyn in, and I suppose once Corbyn is elected, if she doesn't ask call for an extension, then it will definitely mean that we will leave on a clean break World Trade Organization terms. But if she calls a general election and then asks the European Union for an extension of Article 50, then that creates the possibility that she could still try to present her deal again after a general election, and it also means that Corbyn could theoretically renegotiate Brexit to suit himself should he win the general election that Theresa May calls. Well, so that still in a situation where there's a degree of uncertainty as to what the outcome would be. It really is a very interesting time. You know, people, there is this sort of phrase, isn't there, may you live in interesting times, and I think we certainly are living in interesting times, both in terms of the perils that face our country, but also in terms of the fact that there are so many different layers of wrinkles and possibilities that could occur depending upon quite how the dice land in terms of of what goes on in the Palace of Westminster. But as I say, it is all creating this impression in the minds of the public that our politicians are a shower of shit, to be fairly crude about things, and that they are not to be trusted, and that something more fundamental needs to happen in the not too distant future if this country is to stop proceeding along the route that it is towards sort of looming disaster, really.
No, I can see two issues with that. The first one is that she's promised that we will be leaving. We will be leaving on March the 29th. So if she does ask for an extension on Article 50, again, everybody will lose faith in the government. And she's made a big point of saying that we will be leaving. There won't be any extension to Article 50. And the second problem with that is the EU elections are in May. And if there is an extension to it, we still have to be gone by May, because we won't actually have any representatives in the European Union past that time. And we can't possibly be preparing for an EU election at the same time that we're preparing for a general election. It can only be for the general election. So legally, she would be too tied up to actually do that, because we wouldn't actually have any Euro MPs. I mean, what she could do is try to do some kind of manoeuvring where the Euro MPs that we have stay there for an extra amount of time, even though they haven't been voted in. But again, that would mean the EU setting a new precedent. So they really are really tied up with this. I think the only way to get out of it is if she calls for an election and says, and we're still leaving the EU. And the election is for a couple of days after we've actually left. That would ensure that we had left, we did actually get Brexit, and then, you know, everything would be up in the air as to who would actually win this election. And she would probably step down, I think, as well, because she knows that she's not liked. And then that would give a chance for, you know, the public to have their say on who they wanted to be leading the Tory party. I think the feeling among the general public is that it needs to be genuinely conservative and not progressive and liberal.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And I think that if that outcome was the case, and we did end up as a result of default ending up with a clean break Brexit, there would be a sudden revelation in the minds of the majority of the public that of the degree to which we've all been lied to about the possible economic consequences, because lots of people have amongst the Remainer camp have stood up and said, oh, you know, a clean break Brexit could end with X happening or Y happening, and these have all been dire things that are intended to be blood-curdling and to make people feel that it's a hopeless situation and we've got to submit to continued membership of the European Union, or at least a sort of Brexit in name only kind of situation. And I think if we were suddenly catapulted into a clean break Brexit situation, people would realise, because there is no reason why anything should change, because, you know, the fact that we are technically outside the European Union doesn't mean that we would have to enforce a hard border in Ireland. You know, we haven't had a hard border in Ireland for 20 years, and nothing dire has happened as a result of it. So if we didn't have a hard border in Ireland the day after Brexit, it really wouldn't matter. If we didn't have a hard border a week after Brexit, it really wouldn't matter. It would be no change from the situation we're in at the moment. And as far as tariffs are concerned, you know, there are no tariffs in terms of trade between the UK and the European Union at the moment. And if the day after Brexit, both sides stood back and didn't start imposing tariffs, then there would be no need for border checks, and there would be no need for any disruption. We could have a clean break Brexit where we just continue to trade in the time-honoured fashion that's been established over the last 40 years. There is absolutely no need for us to be members of the European Union. We only have to be members of the European Union because the people who are guiding the European Union project, the people that the behind-the-scenes puppet masters of the European Union, that theirs is just a quest for empire building and for political power. It's a game of power politics. You know, they create this impression that we have to give them dominion over our country if we are to trade with them. And the reason given is that it's a necessary thing to create this single market in order for the trade to be conducted in an orderly fashion. Well, you know, that's just it's a sort of an emperor with no clothes kind of situation. It's the man behind the screen in Yellow Brick Road. It's just a false thing. You know, we've been trading with no tariffs with the European Union for the last 40 years, and if we carried on doing that after Brexit, it wouldn't make an atom of difference. We could carry on doing that. It would only be if one side or the other decided to try and exploit that situation and enter into, as I say, one of these sort of political power games. But the sight of the European Union doing that would actually be an admission on their part. You know, if they unilaterally started applying tariffs to British goods exported to the European Union, that would be a clear indication that they're employing an economic weapon in an economic war with Britain in order to bully us into accepting their dominion over us. That would be a clear, and even for the most committed Remainer, for them to see the European Union effectively using their economic power in the same way that many European dictators have used their military power in order to extend their dominion over Britain, it then exposes the European Union as this kind of megalomaniac empire of evil that it actually is.
I think they're absolutely terrified that's what's going to happen, that there will be a World Trade Organization Brexit, and we will see that all these terrible things that we've been warned about don't actually happen, and we'll see once again that we've been lied to. We were lied to about what would happen if we voted in the referendum for Brexit, and everything that they said was going to happen the next day didn't happen, and it's the same thing now. They interviewed a lot of students the other day. I forget whether it was on Channel 4 or on BBC 2, and a hell of a lot of them were supportive of Brexit, and they were saying that they voted to stay in the EU. But now that they've seen what the EU is really like and the way that the EU treats us, they now support Brexit. And the interviewer was very surprised about this because he was expecting young people to all be wanting to stay within the EU. So I think that the general public have really seen the EU for what it is, for being a bully that is just, and our government are being seen for what they are as well, just lickspittles that are just doing the European Union's bidding. And Theresa May doesn't even know what her vision is of Britain without the EU, because she's just so used to being in the EU. That's all she's ever done. And we really need people leading the country that believe in Brexit, that want to make a real go of it. And that's what should have happened straight away. I really can see that we're going to leave on World Trade Organization terms. And the last 2 years has just been prevarication so that the EU can prepare for this and make its demands. Because we could have left on World Trade Organization terms the very next day after the referendum. And that's what everybody expected. That's what David Cameron thought was going to happen. That's why he stepped down, so that somebody who was a Brexiteer could lead the Conservative Party. And that didn't happen. Once the excitement had gone away after about 24 hours, they went into Plan B. They went into emergency mode and changed it all.
That's right, because although Article 50 does mention a two-year term during which negotiations can take place, it is a maximum period during which negotiations can take place. There's no requirement that the discussions have to take 2 years, and we could have decided that yes, we were going to leave on World Trade Organization terms. In fact, we only need to have a period of discussion for a deal if we want to leave on terms that are other than World Trade Organization terms. And so if we wanted to leave on that basis, we could have left the day after, as you say. Although, you know, if we wanted to give the European Union an opportunity to offer us some more attractive terms, we could have given them 3 months notice and left after 3 months. And then just said to the European Union, if you want to offer us something more attractive than World Trade Organization terms, then come and let us know. And that would have then put them in the position where they were coming to us, asking us to listen to them, And we could have stuck our noses in the air and looked the other way and been all haughty, and we would have had the upper hand in terms of the negotiations, whereas Theresa May waited for something like sort of 6 months before she actually even invoked Article 50, and then invoked Article 50 with the intention that the negotiation process was going to take 2 years. So she's effectively created this 2.5 year hiatus during which the future of the political future of Britain is completely uncertain. And that is, you know, probably the worst thing she could have possibly done, because from the point of view of British industry and British farming, you know, the one thing they don't want is uncertainty. You know, if you're running a business and you've got to invest money in plants and machinery and equipment in order to keep your business going, if you've got to employ people, you can't do that if you're in a situation, well, you can't do it properly if you're in a situation where you don't know what's going to happen. And so what's tended to happen over this last 2.5 year period is that we've been stuck in a situation where people who wanted to invest in industry in this country have been reluctant to do that, and they've sat on their money, or they've put, you know, directed their money somewhere else where there is some certainty. And as far as agriculture is concerned, where farming families would previously have over this 2.5 year period been investing in the plant and machinery that they employ in their businesses, they've not been doing that because they just don't know what their trading terms are going to be after the 29th of March this year. And so the economic performance of Britain for the last 2.5 years has been massively compromised by virtue of the fact that Theresa May wasn't bold enough to just opt for a clean break Brexit and then negotiate terms with the European Union. And if we'd done that, then they would have been falling over themselves to negotiate with us. And the negotiating, even if we didn't eventually stick with a clean break Brexit, if we, you know, we could have subsequently negotiated more favourable terms, but the negotiation process would have been that much faster because with the situation as it is at the moment, you know, what we've been through over the last 2.5 years, we've been the losers in all of this because the European Union, that they know that the European Union is going to carry on in pretty much the way it always has done. Okay, it's going to be minus Britain, but they know that anyway. And so from their point of view, there's far less uncertainty, and the last 2.5 years has done far less damage to them than it's done to us. And all this damage isn't as a result of Brexit, it's as a result of Theresa May's cack-handed handling of the Brexit negotiation process.
Imagine if she'd said straight away, well, we're going to do a deal with the EU. There'd have been absolute uproar. You know, the choice was between David Cameron doing his deal, he did his deal, he came back, or rejecting the deal and leaving the EU. You imagine if they'd said the next day, well, we're going to need some time to do a deal. Nobody would have stood for it. She waited 6 months, a year, waited until they triggered Article 50 and then went on to, oh, well, we've got to do this deal and we're doing this deal with them. No, we don't need to do a deal with them. We just need to leave. I mean, the deal says we've got to pay 39 billion euros to them. We're going to stay in the customs union, which is what the EU is a customs union. And the choice of whether we stay like that forevermore is the EU's to make. We can't even say, right, well, we've finished with our deal now. Now we're going to put a stop to this. The EU is the one that says whether they're going to put a stop to it. And it makes Northern Ireland effectively a part of the European Union. I mean, this deal is just set to implode right from the very start. And it just seems to me that it's all just prevarication for these last 2.5 years leading up till now. And it is exciting times that we live in. I will place a bet that's what's going to happen. She's going to announce a general election to ensure that we do actually leave. And then we will leave and we'll have the general election. But you also brought up there, Max, about the yellow vests in France and their uprising against globalism, basically. And they want Macron to step down. And we've also had a manifestation of yellow vests in Britain, but on both sides of the political spectrum. On the right, we've had James Goddard and about 100 yellow vests who've actually been doing it for the last two or three weeks. They've been holding up traffic. They've been protesting. They've been hanging around outside the Houses of Westminster, where Sky TV and BBC have got their outdoor platform stages where they've been interviewing politicians. And when these politicians have been interviewed, they've been singing at them. They've been chanting things like Subri is a Nazi or Kate Burley is a liar, all these sort of things that they've been doing. And they've got a lot of attention for that. And then this weekend, the left, in particular the Communist Party, they had a yellow vest protest as well. But they were protesting against austerity and saying that we should stay within the EU and they wanted a general election. But on the right hand side, on the right wing side of it, they've been saying, well, we want Brexit and we're not happy with what's going on. And the big news last week was the fact that James Goddard, who is leading them, although they say they haven't got a leader, so I guess he's just a spokesman for the yellow vests. And he was leading the chanting of Subri is a Nazi, and he was trying to interview her afterwards. And she's kicked up a huge fuss about this, which ended up getting, I think, 50 MPs to write a letter to Cresta Dick, the chief of the Metropolitan Police, saying that the politicians and journalists were being intimidated, there was an atmosphere of fear, and the police need to do something about it. They need to arrest these protesters. And effectively, all the protesters were doing were singing. And all year long, we've had Ramona protesters that have been interrupting the news reports with EU flags and chanting about staying within the EU. But the minute that there are Brexiteer protesters, then suddenly the police have to do something about it and all this has to be stopped. And James Goddard was arrested on Saturday. And he's been given the usual bail conditions that nationalists get. And he seemed to be quite surprised to actually get this. But of course, we know that nationalists, this is one of the ways that they prevent nationalists from protesting, is to put them on bail with bail conditions that prevent them from actually going to the areas that they need to be protesting in. I've got a quote here from James Goddard when he was released. He says, "I've been released on bail with the most draconian, unlawful conditions. The establishment think they're going to silence me. I'm telling you now, it won't happen." Close quote. And he's been prevented from going into Subri's constituency. I think he's been prevented from going into Burko's constituency. He's been prevented from going to the Houses of Westminster. He's got to go and sign on at the police station twice a week. He's effectively been prevented from taking part in any protests. And Anna Subri, who was the one that was complaining about this, who was saying that she was intimidated, she was fearful, all the rest of it. If you actually look at the video, she's just laughing and joking with them. She's smiling from ear to ear. There isn't one frame of that video that shows her looking as if she's in any type of fear whatsoever. So to be complaining that the police didn't do anything, she seemed to be quite happy about this. Did you watch any of this happening, Max? I was actually watching the news when they were chanting Subri is a Nazi. That was quite hilarious, I thought. What were your thoughts?
Yes, I did see some of it, and it's the thing that struck me is that it's been ignored. This kind of barracking in the street has been ignored for decades, really. And you know, whenever any nationalist groups have organised any meetings or have organised any demonstrations, we've always had the Antifa people turning up and at various points along the route of a march or outside any buildings where we've had meetings, and they've all been chanting in the same way. And the police have never done anything about it. The police have always adopted the attitude that this is just fair comment on the part of these people, and that you know, we live in a free country and they have freedom of speech, etc. And yet it's interesting that Anna Subri has mentioned in one of the interviews that she had that she's a criminal barrister and that she regards the accusation or the assertion that she's a Nazi as being a criminal offence. So here we have a criminal barrister claiming that it's a criminal offence to call somebody a Nazi in public, and yet for decades the police have never ever taken that same opinion and never ever enforced it. And I think this is another example of there being one law for those people who are within our political establishment, where they've got the power to bend the way in which things are perceived in their favour, and another law for the ordinary people of this country who are just trying to do the decent thing and exercise their right of free speech. It just smacks of a double standard, in my view. In terms of the footage that I saw, Anna Soubry certainly wasn't in a distressed state. She was complaining to the police officers that were there, and I think police officers that were there were probably just according her the same protection under the law that would have been offered to any other member of the public. But of course, she doesn't see herself as being any other member of the public. She sees herself as a criminal barrister, as a member of parliament, as a very important person, somebody who didn't ought to have to put up with the sort of thing that ordinary people in this country have been putting up with for years.
Yeah, well, she was just laughing at it. She was just smiling and laughing and appeared to be joking with the people that were doing it. There was no threat there from what I could see. When all the talking heads were talking about it on the news, they kept bringing up hate speech and the far right and attacking ethnic minorities and, you know, it's stirring up hate. And that wasn't what was going on at all. They were just barracking this politician that they perceived to be a traitor. I've actually got the quote here where she says that it's a criminal offence. Speaking later on Sky News, Soubry said, "I don't have a problem with people demonstrating and making their views heard. I have a real problem with people who call me a traitor or Soubry, you Nazi. That is a criminal offence and I'm a criminal barrister. I'm also a lass from Worksop, so I don't get scared by these people or intimidated. I was a reporter during the miners' strike, so I don't feel physically intimidated. My difficulty is I want to respond, and you mustn't, so I'm really behaving myself." So how can she say that she is fearful and scared and intimidated, and then when she speaks on Sky News, she says, "No, I wasn't intimidated at all. I wasn't fearful at all." She also says there that she wanted to respond and she didn't. And it looked to me like she was actually giving an interview to James Goddard as she was walking along the street. He did also barrack Owen Jones there. Did you want to say something there, Max, before I move on to Owen Jones?
Yeah, I was just going to say, this is just a pretext that is used to silence James Goddard. It's not a matter that Anna Soubry is actually genuinely upset or genuinely felt intimidated or anything of that sort. It is just a mechanism. So the police have since arrested James Goddard. They've released him on bail with various restrictions. And so what they've done is they've created a situation now where if James Goddard continues to do what he's been doing, then it will be contempt of court. And so he will criminalise himself through exercising his, what otherwise would be his freedom of expression, freedom of speech. And so it is a cynical ploy on the part of the establishment to shut him up and to serve, again, as a warning to other people who might want to do the same thing. I think in terms of people who hold privileged positions within our society, they like to assume that they should have greater rights accorded to them. On the one hand, claim to be the victims whenever they are criticised, or they claim to be affronted, or they claim to be insulted, or whatever it happens to be, and then they get the police involved, and because of the influence that they have with the police eventually are pushed into taking some sort of action, albeit perhaps reluctantly. They decide to take some action, and the action they take is an arrest and a release on bail with the sort of conditions that shut people up. And we've seen this with nationalists who've been arrested for exercising their freedom of speech. We've seen it with Jez Turner. We've seen it with Paul Golding, where they those individuals have been arrested, put in prison, and then they've been released. They've been offered early release on the basis that they abide by certain conditions, and these conditions are, you know, by and large, draconian, and that they inhibit the person's ability to use the internet. They inhibit their person's ability to communicate, to attend political meetings, that sort of thing, and they effectively neutralize that person if the person was to abide by all of those restrictions. And the restrictions are deliberately made unreasonable, so that there is the temptation on the part of the individual, if the individual is strong-willed, to resist and to break those conditions out of sheer determination. And of course, by breaking those conditions, that it makes that person a criminal. They're in breach of contempt of court, and they then face police charges and can be sent to prison for, as I say, exercising their freedom of speech. It's a very cynical ploy employed by people within the political establishment to suppress freedom of speech.
Well, are they setting a precedent here then, where if anybody calls somebody else a Nazi, that's a public order offence? I mean, it would be good if they are, because it's normally nationalists that are accused of being Nazis. I mean, that's what he's been arrested. He's been arrested and charged with a public order offence, and all he was doing was singing Subri is a Nazi. So it'd be interesting to see if that does set a precedent. But the thing is, I mean, I can remember Nigel Farage was going to a pub with his family, and he got mobbed in a pub, and nothing was done about it. Jacob Rees-Mogg was at home with his family, and he got mobbed by anarchists, and nothing was done about it.
Yes, and Nick Griffin tried to hold an open-air press conference within the precinct of the Palace of Westminster a few years back, I remember, and was then attacked and pelted with eggs. And everybody in the media thought that it was incredibly funny and amusing thing, and that Nick Griffin had got his just desserts. But, you know, Nick Griffin, I think, was at the time a Euro MP, and he should have been accorded the same protections that are being offered to Anna Soubry. And so, again, it's a double standard, depending upon which side of the political spectrum you're on.
Well, the interesting thing about that incident, it was Nick Griffin and Andrew Bronze trying to give a press conference, and they were attacked, they were egged, they were shouted at, they were accused of being Nazis. And one of the main people involved in it was Owen Jones, and he's on camera doing this. And the thing is, this apparent public order offence against Soubry, it was also mentioned that, you know, Owen Jones was also being barracked at the time, and he was being called a Nazi, and he was being called a traitor. And then the 50 MPs, when they wrote this letter, they mentioned this as well, and oh, how terrible it was that journalists like Owen Jones were being called nasty names. And then this footage appears, and he's one of the main ringleaders that are doing exactly the same thing to Nick Griffin, and nothing's been said about that. And also, Owen Jones was calling Goddard gammon. And now this gammon phrase is a new one, and this is quite clearly a racist phrase for white people. Apparently, it's supposed to refer to middle-aged, fat, far-right activists. And basically, it's because gammon is pink. And they're saying that people that drink too much, people that are overweight, they go red in the face, so they look like gammon. I mean, that's what I'm guessing it is. But it's still a derogatory name that is based on somebody's skin colour. And nobody seems to be saying anything about that. That's how Owen Jones was responding to this with anti-white racism.
I think that gammon is a reference to honky and honking of pigs, because that was where the term honky came from in American culture. And gammon obviously is the flesh of a pig, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't think they're saying that nationalist activists are pigs. I mean, we get accused of being terrorists, not the police.
No. What I'm saying, it's another way of calling somebody a honky, isn't it? Which is a derogatory term for a white person.
Well, I guess honky. But what do you mean with honky there then? How does that relate to gammon?
You were saying that it is a racial epithet, and I'm just really agreeing with that. I think that the calling somebody gammon particularly in this kind of scenario where the person that you're calling gammon is somebody who is a nationalist, is intended to be racially insulting to them. That's the impression that I gain from that, on the basis that a gammon is the flesh of a pig, and pig is where the term honky comes from.
Right. I didn't know that was where that's where the
white honkies, because white people have, well, pigs have got sort of pink skin.
I wasn't aware of that. That was where the term honky actually came from. But you would think this. You would think that, that somebody would bring this up and point this out, because it seems quite acceptable to use. The Guardian journalists use it. I think I've seen them use it at the Daily Mail, which seems to have gone totally against.
Somebody should put one of these people on the spot and ask them to explain what this term gammon actually means and where it's derived from, and that might sort of embarrass them into stopping using it.
Well, this is one of the other issues that I wanted to bring up. I mean, James Goddard has brought attention to what he's doing. He has managed to get media exposure for this, but when you actually watch him and he's confronting people like Owen Jones, he's just calling them names. He's just calling them names. When really, he should have been challenging them on some of the things that they've said, and asking them probing questions, and bringing up the fact that he was calling Nick Griffin a Nazi and involved in all of this, rather than behaving like the left do and just chanting names at them. That's one thing that I noticed about this that I thought there could have been an improvement to.
I think that this whole issue really smacks of double standards. And as I say, it smacks of double standards in Anna Sue Rhee wanting protection from facing the kind of public barracking that ordinary members of the public have to face. It smacks of double standards where she claims to be a criminal barrister, but she's never ever spoken up in defence of anybody, any ordinary person that's been accused of being a Nazi publicly by Antifa. You would have thought that being a public-spirited criminal barrister, she might have offered her services on a pro bono basis to help people that have been called Nazis in public to sue the people that have used that term in a derogatory sense, and to help them gain compensation. I would have thought, somebody who's entered public life and become an MP, that's the kind of thing that they perhaps would do if they were trying to be fair-minded. But obviously hasn't occurred to Anna Soubry, so perhaps in future, when nationalists demonstrate in public and we have these scenes of Antifa people chanting Nazi, Nazi at everybody, that Anna Soubry will come forward and offer her services on a pro bono basis. I look forward to that.
Well, I'm wondering just what criminal law she's referring to when she says that that's a criminal law that's being broken. If it is, I'd very much like to know which one it is, because it looks to me as if the police are just being used as the private security force for the politicians. And the police knew that there was no laws that were actually being broken. But as soon as the politicians start squealing about it and writing letters to them, Cresta Dick, who is a political appointee, she's not there because she's a top quality policewoman. She's there because she's a woman. She's there because she covered up for the shooting of John Charles Menezes, the execution of him. And he was the wrong guy, this electrician, and she was responsible for the covering up of that. So that's why she's been put in the position she's in. She's only about 5 foot tall. She's hardly the presence of a police officer, so they've been able to write to her, and they've been able, and because of that, because she's a political appointee, she knows how she got to that position. So she's just when the politicians have clicked their fingers, she's jumped to it. And she's had this Goddard guy arrested, but I don't know under what law, what pretext they're going to use in court. I don't know what law there is that says that calling somebody a Nazi is against the law. It's not hate speech. It's not incitement to racial hatred. They said it's a public order offence. That's what these public order offences normally are. But are they going to say singing at her? That's the public order offence. Is it against the law to sing? It's going to be interesting to see what happens. I mean, what they may do is just keep rebailing him. I mean, that's a trick that they've used on nationalists. They just keep rebailing you. until the year is up, and then they come out with some new charges or a new investigation, and they roll it over, and they keep bailing you for another year. And it means that these nationalists are out of action, as it were, and the activists can't actually do anything in public because they're on these onerous bail conditions all the time. So it may not even get to court. They may just use this to keep Goddard from going into London and keep him out of London for a year or two, and then just drop the charges. You know, that's a possible outcome from this. Max, have you got anything else you'd like to say about this before we move on to something else?
Just, I agree with you entirely. It's just it's almost certainly a cynical ploy, and I would think that the only criminal offence that could be incurred by calling somebody a Nazi would be slander. And so I'm not sure whether perhaps there is such a thing as criminal slander. If you call somebody something with the intention of inciting hatred towards them by other members of the public, that may well be the case. So perhaps that's the criminal offence she's referring to. Or it could just be that the police are using the behaviour likely to occasion a breach of the peace kind of thing. And so, you know, he may well have been bailed on the basis that he was behaving in a way which could cause a breach of the peace, or which could I don't know quite how that relates to the Public Order Act, but I'm sure there probably is some kind of crossover connection there as well.
Well, it might be libel laws. It might be trying to say that it's libelous to call her a Nazi.
That's what I mean. Slander is spoken libel, whereas libel is written. Slander is spoken defamation, whereas libel is written defamation.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up.
If you're saying the words and not having written them down, then it would be slander.
Singing them. He was singing them. Just singing. That's all they were doing when you think about it. They were just singing at them. You compare that to Frank Metzger in the Alternative for Deutschland party, who was leaving a cultural event in Germany last weekend when three Antifa smashed him over the head with a heavy weapon and almost killed him. He woke up in hospital, and the poor guy's in a right state. I mean, this was an assassination attempt. And this happened within days of the same left-wing groups, the same left-wing people, blowing up the Alternative for Deutschland offices over there in Germany. An incendiary device, a bomb. They let a bomb off and then tried to kill one of the MPs. And they still haven't been designated as a terrorist organization. They haven't got terrorist police involved. They've just got normal police involved. And you contrast that to James Goddard's singing at Anna Soubry and all the fuss that's been made over that. It really does show you the double standards that are operating within the West. Well, I've got a couple of other news stories that actually relate to what we were talking about last time, Max, about the refugees or so-called refugees that are coming to Britain and what is the magnet that's bringing them here. And the magnet is that none of them are going to be get sent back. Even if they fail to win their asylum status, half of them just get to stay here. And even if they do fail their asylum seeking status, they only get £2 less each week. I've got a report here from the Times. It says more than 50,000 failed asylum seekers have stayed in Britain because the Home Office is removing less than half of migrants whose applications fail, a report says today. Many of those in the country illegally are thought to work in the black economy, and others have simply disappeared from the Home Office's radar. David Wood, a former Director General of Immigration Enforcement at the Home Office, said in his report for the think tank Civitas that many asylum applications were made not by refugees, but by economic migrants exploiting the system to stay. Sajid Javid, the Home Secretary, was criticised last week for questioning whether people who had crossed the Channel in small boats were genuine asylum seekers, which of course they weren't because France is not at war. The Civitas report said that of 80,800 applications refused or withdrawn in the 7 years to the end of 2016, only 29,600 people were removed, leaving 51,100 still in the UK. Between 10,000 and 15,000 people applying per year had no valid claim, the report said, yet less than half were removed. Applications that waited more than 6 months for a decision rose from 4,000 in 2010 to 14,300 last year. Removals fell from about 15,000 a year in the 2000s to 5,000 last year. So only a third of them are now being removed than were before. The report also details abuse of the system by people making claims only when they are found working illegally or even at the point of being removed. A common method of deception was nationality swapping, Mr. Wood said, in which a Kenyan may claim to be from Somalia because it is harder to remove Somalians. Others claim to be under 18 because even if their claim is rejected, they will not be removed. Some asylum seekers destroy documents that could prove their identity or nationality. The government must then persuade the nation they are believed to be from to take them back, which many states, including Iran, refuse to do. And I think that answers our question as to why the would-be invaders were claiming to be Iranian, because they know that Iran won't take them back. So Britain will be stuck with them. So this is quite clearly why they say, oh, we're from Iran, because they know that they're not going to be sent back. I've got, do you want to say something about that, Max?
Yeah, well, there are organisations, this has been exposed time and time again, that there are organisations in the countries that these people come from that coach them in the things that they have to say and the things that they have to do in order to frustrate the normal process of removing them once they gain access to our country. And it's, you know, these organisations exist. As far as our governments are concerned, our governments really only pay lip service to the task of reducing immigration into the country. They have no real intention of reducing immigration into the country, the whole process of border security in this country is a farce. You know, Sajid Javid has announced that these two additional ships are going to be brought back from the Mediterranean in order to safeguard our southern border. But whilst they've been in the Mediterranean, they haven't been preventing migrants from getting into Europe. They've been sailing around the coast of North Africa, picking migrants up and then ferrying them to Italy and to Greece and to Spain. And they'll continue to do the same thing in the Channel. They'll be picking up migrants that are in boats in the Channel just off the coast of France, and they'll then be ferrying them to the ports on the south coast of England. You know, I think that everybody in this country now knows that that is exactly what's going on, that there's no genuine attempt to impose any controls over immigration coming into this country, and that the whole situation is a scandal. You know, it's I've said it, you know, many times before, that when somebody tries to get into our country illegally, they are effectively attempting to steal the benefits of British citizenship. You know, if you had a house and you found a destitute person sitting on your doorstep one day, and you took pity on them and allowed them to stay in your house for a few days till they managed to get themselves sorted out, and once you'd let them into the house, they then started opening the doors and allowing lots of other people to come in who were then overcrowding your house and refusing to go. You know, that would be regarded as illegal, and for somebody to defend their property and to stop their property from being taken over by these invaders, it would be regarded as an entirely proper thing to do. And yet here we are as a nation, unable to defend the borders of our country. We have a government that allows anybody that's found within our territorial waters, or anybody found within the UK to remain. These people then encourage their relatives and friends that are abroad to come and to use the same methods that they've used in order to get into the country. We have legal firms that have been set up by people who are either traitors or people who are immigrants, and who then use the legal mechanism and public funding in order to represent the illegal immigrants that have come into this country in order to enable them to frustrate any official attempts, pathetic though they normally are, to remove them and to send them back. And we just have to accept that there is this situation at the moment. Well, I say accept it. We have to accept the situation exists. We don't like it. We want it to stop as soon as possible. But people have got to realise that this situation will continue, and house prices will continue to rise and will continue to become more and more expensive, because the demand for housing in the UK is going to constantly be driven up by the fact that there are increasing numbers of people in this country. Because mass immigration always brings with it a breakdown of law and order, the mass immigration that we have in this country is causing crime rates to rise, and it's no surprise then when we see that as far as the abduction and luring and into prostitution of young girls in this country, that it's predominantly being done by people of immigrant descent. When we, whenever figures, crime figures are published, where they distinguish between the ethnic origins of the people who've committed the crimes, there is always a disproportionate number of people from immigrant communities that are involved in crimes, and sooner or later, people in this country have got to decide that enough is enough, and we're just not going to tolerate this sort of thing any longer, and begin to vote in large numbers for those political parties that want to put the situation right.
Yeah, it's not just that they're breaking into the house and helping themselves to the fridge and helping themselves to your daughter. In response to that, we're saying, well, you can adopt our family name and then you'll be entitled to everything that we've actually got. So, in effect, right, handing over the will and testament to them and their dependents forevermore. I've got one final report here, again, which deals with what we were talking about last time. This is about what these traffickers are actually telling the would-be invaders. Criminal people traffickers are telling would-be illegal migrants they are almost guaranteed residency in Britain because authorities never send people back, an investigation has revealed. An Afghan man named Anam, who bragged about having helped 300 third world migrants break into Britain, told undercover reporters he could set up a speedboat crossing from mainland Europe to Great Britain for just £6,000 per person, or for the lower cost of £2,500 a head, organise a trip in a three-person dinghy. Really, you just cross the water. Then, if the police catch you, no problem. They will never send you back, boasted Anam, who was introduced to journalists through two Afghans who had promised them that the 28-year-old fixer will get your man to England. So, I mean, it's quite open that this is what they're being told, that all they have to do is just get in the boat, get halfway across the channel, and they'll be picked up by the police, and that's it. They're in paradise. They're in the land of milk and honey, where everything's paid for.
What we've got to realise is that a very large proportion of the migrants coming to the UK have come from war-torn countries where there has been a complete and utter breakdown in law and order. So they've come from a situation where there is a great amount of violence, where there is a great amount of lawlessness, and where large proportions of them have been combatants on one side or the other. There's been lots of instances where people who have been claiming asylum have later been shown to have been combatants, either on one side or the other, in Syria, for example, or in Afghanistan or Iraq. And these people very often are fleeing the countries that they previously lived in, not necessarily because of a lack of law and order, but because they're often wanted for criminal offences. And in a city, all other factors aside, if you have a situation where there is mass immigration into an area where the majority of the people coming in are young men of military age, it always produces a breakdown in law and order. And this is why, as far as the colonization of North America was concerned, by Europeans, because a very disproportionately large number of the European migrants to North America were young men of military age. They were young men who wanted to go out there and who, you know, who felt that they could carve out some kind of a career for themselves by buying or acquiring, by whatever means, the land that existed over there. And that's where the term the Wild West was coined, because there were large numbers of people who had no respect for law and order and who were young men full of testosterone and as a result of that, the confrontations caused by that immigration, there was a fair amount of lawlessness. And the only way that an end was put to that, and as I say, a similar situation existed in Australia, and in both those countries, the thing that put an end to that was law and order being imposed in a very draconian way by the state, and where large numbers of people who were criminals in North America and in Australia were hung until such time as the balance of the population was redressed, and then those countries both became very peaceful countries and very productive countries. And so the cure for what's going on here in Britain and what's going on in Europe, where we can see crime rates rising as a result of mass immigration into our country, is either that we stop the migrants coming and send them back, or that we impose very draconian law and order policies where those people that are that have got into the habit of defying the law and of circumventing the law and of breaking the law are dispatched in no uncertain terms in very great numbers.
Are you suggesting we bring back lynching, Max?
I'm not suggesting we bring back lynching. What I'm suggesting is that a British government will need at some point in the future, if mass immigration continues, a British government will need at some point in the future to have a very much stronger police force than we have, and a very much more forthright judiciary than we have, so that people who commit serious offences that undermine the rule of law in this country are dispatched very quickly and in their days swinging from a yardarm.
Yeah, you know, that's the only two choices, really. And even then, if they do increase with the law and order, it's just going to be never ending. Just never ending. The violence that these non whites cause, and the crime rate that goes up. That the real way to deal with it is just to deport them. Deport. Start with the ones that carry out the crimes, and then entice the ones that aren't carrying out the crimes with financial sweeteners to go back to where they came from. That's the way to deal with it. That's the way to get the crime rate down. And that's what the majority of the British people and the European people in their nations want. None of us were ever asked whether we wanted to be replaced. Anyway, we've got a little bit over time here, Max. So thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Aryan Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
To the anti-white system on RadioArea.com.